This is Chuck Coughlin again, setting the record straight on breadboxmedia.com. Why don't you consider with me the first three centuries of the Catholic Church? When people today talk about the early Christians in these first centuries, but they're Catholics, they were all Catholics. Why don't we call it the early Catholics? Well, a lot lays behind that distinction, and we're going to talk about that today. Take the word church with a capital C. What was the church in the Roman Empire? The conception that I would like to set straight today is of the early church, the early Christians, we call them. It was not a vague, disorganized group. No, it was highly organized. Christ organized it, and it grew from there, like a seed crystal. So let's take a clear look at it. We know a lot about the early church. But let's put ourselves in the place of a man living in a particular period, from whose standpoint the nature of the connection between the church, the Catholic Church, and the empire can best be accurately observed. And that standpoint in time is the generation which lived through the close of the second century and on into the latter half of the third. Then, if we did that, we'd find ourselves in a world where the growing church was still but slightly known and by most people completely unheard of. We can get no earlier view of it as part of society around it. It is from about this time also that many documents survive, thank God. In this setting, the record state, we're going to show that the appearance of the church at this time, from 150 to 240 years after the crucifixion, there is ample evidence of her original constitution. So we know just what the Catholic Church was like at that time. Now, many people who I know and friends of mine are surprised by that assertion. They think there's sort of a fog over those early centuries, and we weren't really sure how early Catholics lived at that time or what the interactions of people were. Well, yes, we do. This was a very literate society. Surprise. The Roman Empire had 7.5 million literate people at that time. Plenty of literacy around for those that need be. And there were the scribes to record letters. And for those people that were not literate in the two languages they used themselves, Greek and that great white language, Latin. Called a great white language because it was like a highway of ideas and commerce and concepts and philosophies and religions that went throughout all the Roman Empire, so that a person from the eastern edge of the Roman Empire could communicate, sit and talk, or if they were writing, they could write letters to somebody on the western edge of the Roman Empire. Everyone knew Latin. Come with me on a time travel back into the second century now. And see yourself there. Let's think of a man. Maybe it's you. Put your time boots on. And even if you're a woman, especially if you're a woman, imagine yourself as a man born shortly after the time of the reign of Marcus Aurelius. The reason we imagine ourselves as men is because it was a patriarchy. It was the Roman patriarchy. The Roman patriarchy that the church shattered with the message of Christ. The glass ceiling was shattered there. And women were equal to men before the eyes of God. But this was the Roman society, and it determined how things were. The real changes in the status of women were to occur in the next century and the century after that. And it would be a dramatic revolution, due entirely to the influence of the Catholic Church and of the marvelous invention of the nuns. Free to choose their own bridegroom, no arranged marriages. They chose their own bridegroom, Christ. So for the purposes of this story that we're embarking upon, all of us, children, girl or boy, man or woman, let's imagine ourselves as a mature man, a citizen in the Roman Empire at that time. And if we were to be aware of the Catholic Church, what would we see? Well, this man that we are, living through the violent civil wars that succeeded the peace, that followed a long period of peace when the Antonines ruled, surviving to witness the Decian persecution of the church, and in an extreme old age to perceive the promise, though not the establishment, of an untrammeled Catholicism. Yes, it had yet to pass through the last and most terrible of its persecutions. Well, we would have been able to answer our question well. What did the Catholic Church look like? He would have lived at the turn of the tide, a witness to the emergence, apparent to all of society, of the great Catholic Church. Let us suppose that we are the head of a senatorial family in some great provincial town. Let's say Lyon. We'd find ourselves one of the comparatively small class of very wealthy men to whom was confined the municipal government of the city. There were two classes below us. There would be a large class of citizens just below us, free men, but not senatorial. Beneath these, again, is society and is almost its foundation, a very large body of slaves. Now, in what proportion these three classes of society would be found in a town like Lyon's in the second century, we have no exact documents to tell us. But you can infer from what we know of that society that the majority would certainly have been of the servile class. Free men, less numerous, while senators were certainly a very small body. And we must add to these three main divisions two other classes, yes, which complicate our view of that society. The first was that of the freedmen. The second was made up of perpetual tenants, nominally free but economically bound to the wealthier class. It was a social arrangement, and no more. Most of the slaves were indeed still chattel bought and sold, many of them. So let's say we're walking through the streets of Lyon. It's morning. We're going to attend a meeting of the Curia. We'd be saluted, and we'd salute. Some he would greet with great familiarity, even though they were slaves. He'd be accompanied, it may be presumed, by a small retinue. As he went along that street, there would be temples on either side, dedicated to a variety of services. No creed dominated the city. Even the local gods were now but a confused memory. A religious ritual of the official type was to greet him upon his entry into the assembly. But in the public life of the city, no fixed philosophy, no one creed was generally accepted by all. There was a variety. So this is Rome, southern Italy. Abundant supply of marble quarries, abundant supply of artisans with great skill. So there'd be many magnificent buildings. And the buildings dedicated to creeds. There were two that would have commanded the most attention. The one, the great and showy synagogue, where the local Jews met upon their Sabbath. And the other one, a rather small building, a Catholic church. The first of these he would look upon as one looks upon today, a mark of an alien colony in some great modern city. He knew it to be a symbol of a small, reserved, unsympathetic, but a rather wealthy race scattered throughout the empire. Now, the empire had trouble with it in the past, but that trouble was long forgotten. The little colonies of Jews had become negotiators, highly separate from their fellow citizens. Well, a bit unpopular, but nothing more. With the Catholic Church, it would have been otherwise. He would know, because he was an administrator, who was supposed to be a pagan, that this church was endowed, that it was possessed of property, more or less legally guaranteed. It had a very definite position of its own among the congregations and corporations of the city. Very peculiar, yet well secured. He would further know as an administrator that to this small building and the corporation of which it was a symbol were attached an appreciable number of his fellow citizens. It was a small minority, of course, in any town of such a date, the first generation of the third century. But a minority most appreciable and most worthy of his concern from three very definite characteristics. In the first place, it was certainly growing. In the second place, it was certainly a phenomenon perpetually unique. And in the third place, and this is the important point, it represented a true political organism, the only subsidiary organism which had risen within the general body of the empire. The only subsidiary organism. Now please remember this point. The Catholic Church in Lyon would have been for that senator a distinct group, a distinct organization, an organism with its own officers, its peculiar spirit, its own type of vitality, which, if he were a wise man, he would know was certain to endure and to grow, and from which, even if he were but a superficial and unintelligent spectator, he would recognize as unique. Like a sort of little state, the Catholic Church included all kinds and classes of men, and like the empire itself, within which it was growing, it regarded all classes, of its own member as subject to it within its own sphere. The senator, the tenant, the freedman, the slave, the soldier, insofar as they were members of this corporation, were equally bound to certain observances. Did they neglect these observances, the corporation would expel them or subject them to penalties of its own. So let's set the record straight. The church at that time was no vague organization without boundaries and structure. Now you, like I, have surely been subjected to the false version of the early church, that it was vague and disorganized. Not at all. It was recognizably an entity, an organization, and had certain procedures, laws, and was governed by a hierarchy. This is not a picture that is frequently described as loose little groups of Christians wandering about having mass and communion in the back rooms of homes. No, this was very public at this point and organized. Why is this important? Well, the unbroken succession of this organization created by Jesus Christ himself is of vital importance, so that anyone should be able to recognize the true, authentic Church of Christ. Yes, we would know among ourselves that there was no social class in which this Catholic Church had not propagated a knowledge of its customs. We would know that its organization, though in no way admitted by law, and purely what we would call voluntary, was strict and very formidable. Yes, formidable, because members of the Catholic Church were filled with an intense devotion. The Catholic Church was not an opinion, not a fashion, nor a philosophy. It was not a theory. It was not a habit. It was a clearly delineated body, corporate, based on numerous exact doctrines, extremely jealous of its unity and of its precise definitions, and filled to the brim, as was no other body of men at that time, with passionate conviction. As we proceeded along, I might turn to you and say, you know, my friend, men like us recognize the peculiar uniqueness of the Catholic Church. And frankly, it would be a bit disturbing. It's certainly not obscure, small, but remarkable. So let us just forget about this idea that we had for so long, about a vague and insubstantial early Christian church, groups of Christians. No, it was the organized, identifiable, passionate Catholic Church. So this ends part one of this look, inspection of the early church, the early Catholic Church. Look for part two.